Welcome to the Old Frontline podcast question and answer section. In this bonus episode, we'll answer your questions that come out of the episodes of the podcast each week. Do make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite platform, and please give us a like there or even a review. So we had our first question and answer podcast where you can submit questions and I do my best to answer them. And it was well received. I got a lot of really nice comments about it. When I look back on it, probably I kind of spoke a little bit too long with some of the answers, and I'm going to try not to do that this time. And probably I tried to answer too many questions in one go. So it's a learning curve. We've just started with this feature of the podcast, so we'll see how it goes. So let's get down to some questions now that have come in from listeners over the course of the last few weeks. And I've got quite a few and they've built up, and there'll be some more episodes soon where we'll answer some of the other ones that you've sent in. But question number one for this episode is from Linda Michelini. I've heard many times that the Great War was a learning curve for the BEF. I recently read Nick Lloyd's book Passchendaele, and he touches on this, how both the BEF and the Germans adjusted their tactics in response to the actions of the other side. I realise the answer to my question could take up an entire book, but would it be possible for you to give an overview of the subject, some way to make a huge and complex topic comprehensible for those of us without expert knowledge of the history of the war? Well, Linda, thanks for this one. It certainly is a question that we could turn into an entire book and lots of podcasts. But essentially, if we look at the war in 1914, everybody went to war prepared for war, just not the kind of war that the Great War would soon become, a static war, a siege war on an unprecedented kind of scale. So each side and all of the armies involved, and then later ones who joined them, like the Americans, had to learn how to fight this war. So if there is such a thing as a learning curve, it must apply not just to the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, which also includes all of the Australian, Canadian, New Zealander, South African troops, and all of the Empire nations that took part in the war. It doesn't just include the BEF, it must include everyone. And you see evidence of this when you study the different nations' approaches to fighting. The French perhaps adjust quicker than anyone else with the adaptation of trench weapons, the change in their uniform, and all kinds of other trench paraphernalia that they bring in to fight a static war. And the British Army, who throughout the conflict likes to kind of take the initiative, fights an attempt to break the static nature of the war as early as the winter of 1914, when to the south of Ypres, near to Wichita, British troops attack the German positions in that area, pretty much unsupported by artillery fire, over the top with the best of luck, and there are heavy casualties as a result and almost nil gains. So it's clear that you can't just throw men at an enemy position. And what the British Army and all of the units that fight within the BEF do over the course of the rest of the war is really learn how to fight not just the war on the Western Front, but arguably a modern war as well. And if we take the army of 1914, a volunteer army, highly trained, very well equipped, it fights an open war initially, goes static, pretty much loses a huge component of its original force, and then it's replaced with territorials and later volunteers and eventually conscripts. And what the hierarchy of the army has to do is try and pull all those different groups together to form them into coherent forces that can fight battles. And the only way to learn how to do that is to fight those battles and very often make mistakes. And the mistakes, of course, are mistakes that cost men's lives. And I'm sure that is something that historians are going to be arguing about for centuries to come. But there is a clear evidence of learning. Whether it is a learning curve, it's something kind of Gary Sheffield, Professor Gary Sheffield, and several others of his kind of group brought in some years ago. And I think Gary's kind of changed his mind about this now. but there is certainly evidence of learning, whether it's a curve that you can kind of chart through the war. Even when they're kind of learning lessons, they then make the same kind of mistakes. Arras is a good example of this, and one or two other battles besides. But what you see by 1918 is a kind of a peak in this learning, where battles, particularly with actions like Messines, when the army is properly trained from bottom to top to fight a battle, every man is equipped with the tools and the knowledge he requires to go into battle. That, with the combination of the better use of technology, whether it's machine guns, mortars, artillery, tanks, aircraft, or all of them, is what you see kind of come together in those final battles. One nation does not kind of outpit another one in its learning. The Australians do incredibly well in the battles around Le Hamel and Villers-Bretonneux, leading to a kind of an advance in tactics within that corps, the Australian Corps, which emerges out of that fighting. But you see the same in the Canadian Corps, with the perfection of the battles that they take part in, from Vimy, not just Vimy, but Vimy onwards. And then within the British Army, there are many corps commanders who also push their units forward with new methods, new methodology, and new ways of fighting. So what you see is not General Haig at the top, kind of writing battle notes which everyone has to follow. You're often seeing ground-level troops come up with ideas, pitching them to higher command, having those ideas accepted, and gradually the army as a whole changes and learns. And it invests in a huge amount of training. We kind of think the men were just pitched into battle. There were training establishments behind the lines right across the British part of the Western Front, which everybody used, and everybody came to terms, recognised, understood, and developed their own skills in battle. So that these men, I mean, when I go back to interviewing veterans, they were very proud of their service and proud of the kind of soldiers that they were. And for me, one of the great miracles of the conflict is that in 1918, the BEF and all it was comprised of fought these incredible battles, with the British side of it largely made up of 18, 19-year-old conscripts led by veterans of earlier campaigns. But with that kind of force, we were able to beat the Germans hands down. It wasn't that the Germans kind of just lost and withdrew and that was endgame. We beat them. That was the old Hitlerian lie that the German army was never beaten in the field. They were, by better troops, not just British, but French and the Americans when they learned how to fight during the Meuse-Argonne offensive as well. So it's a fascinating subject, the learning curve and learning on the Western Front. And there are many books out there to kind of get you going. Start as you've done with Nick Lloyd, but look at Gary Sheffield, look at the works of Peter Hart and Paddy Griffiths and so many others. There's a whole host of material for you to kind of get to terms with the learning curve. And perhaps that's something we'll return to in a podcast episode again one day. So, question number two. This one from Simon. I know this subject has been discussed, but I still don't fully understand how beaches were defended given the terrain and the tide. Now, what I think you're talking about here, Simon, is the top end of the Western Front where the trenches met the North Sea and the Channel Coast near to the town of Nieuport. And that was a French and then a Belgian sector. British and some Commonwealth troops served there in 1917 as well. And literally the trenches ended on the beach. Now they were facing each other and there was a no man's land in the sand dunes there. There was no kind of patrolling along the beaches. They put wire on the beach to stop men from coming along the beach at night. So there was no kind of fighting as such amongst the kind of waves right on the shore of the beach. There was standard fighting facing each other, static warfare. The Germans attacked there in 1917 and overran quite a few of the British positions. But the defence of that kind of exposed flank with the sea was done by the Navy. The Navy had monitors and small ships up there that were operating on the flanks of the army to defend the sea, the actual physical sea, where the channel kind of met the North Sea, and the Germans were doing the same thing. So there was a naval flank to the Western Front that we don't often consider. There was some great work done on this during the centenary, where they did a kind of a plan of the Channel Coast there, looking at particular wrecks that connected to the history of the naval history of this part of the Western Front and the defence of that sea coast, and then gave some of the perspective. And if I can find the link to that, I'll post it onto the Old Frontline podcast Twitter feed so you can see it. But it is an important part of our understanding that the two ends of the Western Front, the Vosges and the border with Switzerland, but then that kind of sea end where it met the sea in the sand, that is a really fascinating part of the Western Front, and something I'm not just going to return to on the podcast. I've mentioned a little bit in a previous one, but I'm going to be going back there to make a battlefield vlog, hopefully fairly soon, and explain this aspect of the war on the Western Front, hopefully in greater detail. So question number three is from John Tedstone. Listening to the new episode this morning on the way to work, with a couple of days planned in Ypres later this month, I'd like to ask, as a person that has been to many of the places on the Ypres salient already, where would you choose to go back and visit time and time again, given that you've been everywhere in the area many times? Well, that is a really good question, John. I find myself being drawn to areas rather than specific places. The thing about battlefields that I enjoy is kind of getting lost in that landscape. And it is harder at Ypres because of the way, as a city and an area, it has developed. So there's a lot more housing, a lot more industry. The area along the Yser Canal, where the diggers worked in the 90s and early 2000s, has all been swallowed up now, and only that little bit of Yorkshire Trench and a few other things kind of still exist in an area that was a big portion of untouched battlefield, really, that was just farmland. So I kind of find myself being drawn to areas where it's kind of perhaps a bit more rural, and also areas that connect greatly to stories and memoirs of the First World War. So one area that I particularly like walking, which is kind of caught in that no man's land between development and a rural idyll, and that is around Zillebeke. There are so many accounts from different authors who served in that sector, because it was kind of a pinnacle of that part of the salient where units were in and out of the line a lot. So you've got quite a few different accounts. And I love walking from Transport Farm Cemetery via Zillebeke Lake into Zillebeke Village, where you've got the Aristocrat Cemetery, where you've got the men of the regular army officers from second lieutenant through to lieutenant colonels who are drawn from a kind of typical background where they're public school boys, and they come very often from titled backgrounds. There's Lord Gordon Lennox in there and 5th Baron Congleton. And you've got the grave of Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Chesney Wilson of the Royal Horse Guards with that amazing inscription on it: "Life is a city of crooked streets, death the marketplace where all men meet." I mean, if that doesn't stop you in your tracks, I don't know what does. And from there, you can walk out into the kind of rural countryside around Zillebeke, up to Yeomanry Post that looks down towards Sanctuary Wood and Hoog and Hill 62, and then go down to Maple Copse, where the Canadians had their field guns during the battle there of June 1916, and up onto Observatory Ridge. So those kind of places I find myself being drawn back to on a regular basis. But there are certain parts of Ypres that I connect to veterans as well. There's a little stream called the Raverbeke near Polygon Wood, and I've mentioned this in a podcast some time ago, where one of the veterans that I interviewed, he was there in an action in October of 1917 with the Queen's Regiment, which got him the Military Cross, and then from there he went off to serve in Italy. And Hugh Parry Morris, MM of the Honourable Artillery Company, he was in the same area, and he was decorated with his military medal for the bravery in that battle as well. So I have those kind of places that connect me to specific veterans that I interviewed. But I think Ypres itself, really, for me, is a place that I never tire of going to and visiting the Menin Gate. The frustrating thing, although I understand and fully accept the necessity for the work that's taking place on the Menin Gate at the moment, the thing that I miss in the last few times I've been there in this year that it's been inaccessible due to the renovations that are going on, is going there at night when it's quiet, the crowds have dispersed, you have the Menin Gate to yourself, but not quite to yourself. There's the ghosts of more than 50,000 soldiers roaming around you whose names are listed on the panels. it's a powerful, immensely, incredibly powerful place, as all these battlefields are. But I would say to you, go out and find your places, the places that you connect to, based on what you've read, what interests you, and the stories that kind of draw you back, and you'll find your own Ypres salient. And I think that is the beauty of this, because we each have our own little pathway, our own little layer that connects us to these battlefields of the Great War. So, question number four. This one comes from Stephen Hunt, who is a regular commenter on the website pages, and always value his contributions when he talks about the episodes that we put out. So thanks for that, Stephen. And he says, my question is as a result of the Beyond the Somme podcast, where you said that it should inspire us to see beyond the British old front line. How easy is it to get to the French battlefields, Verdun, Chemin des Dames, and the area around Suchet, using public transport? Also, once there, are there any local tour companies that can take you around the battlefields? Well, again, that's a good question. Having kind of launched you off to visit those battlefields beyond the Somme, how can you get there? Well, obviously, the easiest way is to take your own vehicle there and visit those places in your own way. But that's not always possible for everyone. Using public transport to get to any of these battlefields, even quite a lot of the British ones, in inverted commas, is not always easy, because there isn't much public transport in rural areas. And once you get down to Verdun and the Chemin des Dames, you can take the train there. There's a TGV line that goes from Paris to Strasbourg, I think. And there is a Voie Sacrée station on that was meant to link people from the fast line up into Verdun. And I think there is a bus service that takes you from that TGV up into Verdun itself. But Verdun is quite an impressive battlefield, but also a challenging one to visit. And you could walk from the station up onto the heights above the Meuse and visit the forts like Vaux and Douaumont and so on, using Christina Holstein's superb books on the subject. But it would be a pretty mighty hike. And there's nowhere to stay on the actual Cour de Verdun, the heart of Verdun, because it's an area of preserved battlefields. You have to come back into the city or go to one of the villages surrounding it, where there are a few B&Bs or gîtes that you could hire. Chemin des Dames is not dissimilar. It's quite a big area. There is kind of a bit of a public transport network there, a few little stations you could use. But those kind of trips, I would say, do take a lot of planning if you haven't got your own transport. And in terms of local guides, there are a few in those areas. There's some at Verdun now. There's a Dutch guy, Martin, who I met at Montfaucon quite recently, who with his wife run a bed and breakfast and a little private museum, and he does battlefield tours in English and other languages besides, no doubt. But there are some in Verdun itself. You can always ask the tourist office about local guides. I don't know of any specific ones in the Chemin des Dames area, but again, the tourist office may help. And I think the Caverne du Dragon, which is this underground position where both sides met beneath ground and they fought there, which is a superb place to go and visit, I think they do battlefield tours, but don't quote me on that. You'd have to kind of look that up. It is challenging. I mean, I've walked all these battlefields in the early years. I always went on the train. We kind of walked from stations and all this kind of stuff. But there's no doubt that by not having access to your own transport, it does kind of limit your ability to get to all of the places, which is why local guides on British battlefields and French battlefields and American battlefields are so vitally important to help unlock that, not just from a transport point of view, but from a history and an understanding the landscape point of view as well. That is the beauty, the whole point of having a battlefield guide to show you around, to give you the perspective, to tell you the history and the context, and help you understand what it is you are seeing. So kind of seek those people out. But you can, of course, do it yourself. You can take the many guidebooks. Martin, Dutch guy I mentioned, he's written quite a few on the American sectors in the Meuse-Argonne. Christina Holstein's books. There are my books on the kind of walking the battlefields up in northern France. Dave Amara's books on the French, on the Somme, for example, kind of gets you beyond that bit of the Somme into the French sector. And there's the Holt's guides, the Western Front North and Western Front South. So a kind of lot of material out there to help you plan a trip. But planning is the essential part of that kind of thing. I remember in the early days, way before all the digital stuff, I used to sit at my kitchen table with laminated maps and scribble all over those to mark routes and potential areas to explore. That really felt a kind of discovery. And I would recommend that. You can use Google Maps, you can use your iPad or your iPhone or other devices are available, but getting physical maps and scribbling all over them is a really good way of understanding a landscape and then researching that landscape prior to you visiting. So I hope that helps a little bit. So that's it for our kind of extra bonus episode with these questions and answers. I've got plenty more in the pot that I'm going to come to over the course of the next few weeks. We're coming towards the end of season 6 of the podcast. We'll have a little gap and then there'll be season 7, but we've got a little bit more to go yet. And we'll also be returning with these Q&A episodes as well. I said I'd try and keep it a little bit shorter. Please do give me feedback on this. Is it too short now? Is it about right? Did you prefer the longer ones? Like I say, this is kind of my learning curve, going back to Linda's question at the very beginning. But I hope you found this of interest. It kind of sheds light on one or two extra bits of the Great War, and it makes me think about ideas for future episodes, because as ever, the podcast isn't going anywhere, I hope, and I feel, as always, as we're approaching now, getting towards 200 episodes, we're kind of only just started. So, until the next time, keep sending in your Q&As, which you can do via email or via the Discord server, and links to both of those are on the show notes for this podcast episode. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Frontline with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Frontline Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me A Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline.